Hi, I'm Ryan Levy. Welcome to Cyberism's Malicious Life. On November 20, 2012, Andrew Orenheimer, better known as Weave, was found guilty on two charges, identity fraud and conspiracy to access a computer without authorization. He and Daniel Spittler, both members of GoatSea Security, a group equal parts security research team and trolling association, had been arrested for breaching AT&T servers and stealing the email addresses of some 114,000 iPad users. Weave, unsurprisingly, saw things very differently. In an interview with The Guardian, he rejected the notion that he had broken into anything at all. Quote, "I've never broken into anyone's computer. We were accessing public resources. It's like they printed a book and I flipped open the pages and we criticized what they put in the book." End quote. For Weave, this wasn't hacking. It was a public service. He framed the incident as an act of digital activism, not a crime. Writing on the GoatSea Security blog, he explained their motivations. Quote, "This disclosure needed to be made. iPad 3G users had the right to know that their email addresses were potentially public knowledge so they could take steps to mitigate the issue, like changing their email address. This was done in service of the American public." End quote. Weave's claim that the AT&T hack was motivated by ideology, a selfless act to protect the public, might have had merit, but the problem was no one takes him seriously. This, in many ways, is the tragedy of Andrew Orenheimer. Everyone who knows him agrees on one thing. Weave is undeniably smart. His arguments, often laced with historical and cultural references, show a level of knowledge and intellectual depth that's hard to dismiss. He probably does have meaningful things to say. But Weave is such an irredeemable troll, so committed to chaos and deceit, that his credibility is always in question. Take, for example, the Amazon incident of 2009. That year, thousands of gay-themed books mysteriously disappeared from Amazon's search results and rankings. The internet erupted in outrage, accusing Amazon of censorship. Then, in the middle of the firestorm, Weave took responsibility. In a blog post cheekily titled, "How to Cause Moral Outrage from the Entire Internet in 10 Lines of Code," Weave claimed to have found a vulnerability in Amazon's user-powered reputation system. The exploit, he said, manipulated Amazon's system into making the titles as questionable content. But Amazon denied his story, saying the issue was actually caused by an internal glitch affecting more than 57,000 books, many of which had nothing to do with LGBT themes. And that's the essence of Weave. Even when he does something potentially meaningful, his compulsive need to troll, to sow confusion, to lie for the sheer fun of it, undermines any claim to legitimacy. No one can trust a word he says because the lies are part of the game. Instead of recognition or understanding, what Weave gets in return is hatred, and a justified one at that. He is a proud anti-Semite, a white supremacist neo-Nazi, although according to his mother, the family has Jewish ancestry on both sides, and he is an outspoken supporter of eugenics, the systematic killings of quote-unquote undesirables in the name of improving the human race. Tor believes that this hatred is what prompted the Department of Justice to prosecute Weave in the first place.
You think that his personality and all the trolling that he did was a factor in the decision?
Absolutely. You know, the DOJ is a political organization. And like all of us, they operate against a certain background and network of social mores and ethical conceptions or whatever. I mean, you can't function in the world without, you know, some kind of background that you're operating against. But one of the things that they like to do, and I think it's a common feature of prosecutorial systems, is to prosecute the unpopular defendant to expand your reach with certain laws, right? Like they're constantly trying to expand the reach of whatever criminal statute they're using. And the easiest way to do that is to prosecute an unpopular defendant because nobody's going to care, right? And fundamentally, law is a social act, a socio-political act, I think.
Losing the trial, though expected, made Dorr's life even harder. The case had been pro bono, leaving him with no income. But just when things seemed bleak, fate stepped in once again.
I'm terrible at fundraising, but I'm always taking these cases that, like, you know, the defendant has no money, so, like, you know, I'm always, like, living under the threat of constant eviction and crap like that. But we had this, like, C of A defense fund site that had gotten no donations, and all of a sudden all these donations were coming in. And I was like, what's going on? And then I was like, oh, shit, Aaron killed himself, right? Yeah, that was, like, another one of those watershed moments.
Aaron is Aaron Schwartz, an entrepreneur and internet hacktivist who at the time was facing 50 years in prison for quote-unquote stealing a cache of scientific papers and tragically took his own life. His death ignited public outrage, drawing attention to the flaws in computer crime laws and bringing fresh support and interest to Weave's upcoming appeal.
And, you know, all of a sudden, I'm getting all this attention when before I've just been sitting at some desk miserable and drinking like a madman. And my marriage is falling apart at this time too. So it's like a really just wow.
One organization that took notice was the Electronic Frontier Foundation, longtime critics of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and its enforcement. Tor says that the EFF was already aware of Weave's trial, but chose not to get involved until the appeal. And he didn't blame them one bit.
Honestly, I don't fault anybody for that, right? Like, it's just being a trial lawyer is a very specialized, particular skill set that you can't get it from watching videos. You can practice and kind of do, you know, workshops with people, but there is zero substitute for being in a courtroom when everything is at stake, having to cross-examine an FBI witness and getting your ass handed to you because you asked a dumb fucking question or you went too far or you didn't listen or your ego got in the way or some stupid pet theory that you got in your head, you know, just bombed. And you have to be able to get up instantly. So that's why a lot of organizations don't want to get involved, because it's not a desk-bound activity.
For the appeal, the EFF decided to step in, and they brought out the big guns. During the trial, Tor had consulted over the phone with Orrin Kerr, the country's leading expert on computer crime law. But for the appeal, Kerr intended to join the fight in person and even argue the case before the court. Quote, "This case is about the freedom to surf the internet," he said in a blog interview. "Congress never intended to criminalize visiting a public website. Ornheimer's case is the latest chapter in the ongoing battle over the breadth of the CFAA, the sweeping federal anti-hacking law that has been stretched to cover all sorts of non-hacking behavior. Weave's conviction is a prime example of how the CFAA threatens security researchers with prison sentences for discovering security vulnerabilities." End quote. Meanwhile, Weave went to prison and immediately started causing trouble. With help from a friend, he managed to tweet from jail. When that was shut down, he turned to another friend to post voicemail messages on SoundCloud, keeping his voice alive outside the prison walls. As we've recalled in an interview to TechCrunch, quote, "I was repeatedly placed in solitary because I kept intentionally antagonizing the federal government by continuing to speak and troll even from prison. Also, I don't take any shit from anybody, and told all the corrections workers what I think of them." End quote.
So this guy's doing 3.5 years, most of it in solitary, and people wonder why he tattooed a swastika on his chest when he was in there. You know, it's because they fucking broke him. It's because they fucking tortured him, because solitary confinement is a form of torture. And no human being deserves that. No human being deserves that. Because when you engage in that kind of behavior, you're just as barbaric as what you're claiming to punish.
Cyber attacks are inevitable, but every minute counts. Reverse the adversary advantage with efficiency and efficacy. Detect in 1 minute, triage in 5 minutes, and remediate in 30 minutes. This is only possible with CyberReason's malicious operation-centric approach, built with the most advanced AI and strongest layered defense, the highest rated solution by MITRE ATT&CK. Don't accept anything less. CyberReason EPP, EDR, MDR, XDR, and SDR. Future-proofing your security operations. Visit cyberreason.com. The appeal strategy hinged on two key points, the first being the definition of unauthorized access. The FF wrote the following in its blog, quote, "In essence, the government claims that Orenheimer and Spittler obtained the email addresses without authorization under the CFAA because AT&T didn't want them to have the addresses, despite putting absolutely no technical roadblock, such as requiring a login with a username and a password, in their way. As we've warned before, accessing data on a public website isn't criminal, even if the website owner doesn't like how their data is being used. The way to prevent people from accessing data is to restrict access to that data, not to claim some people who visit a website are authorized and others aren't, without any clear mechanism for distinguishing between the two. Allowing AT&T to pass the blame for its poor security onto Orenheimer only discourages security researchers from sharing their discoveries." End quote. The second argument challenged the prosecution's claim of impersonation, asserting that simply changing the user agent field doesn't constitute deceit or unauthorized access. The EFF gave the following analogy to make its point. Quote, "Imagine that a convenience store has posted a sign, 'No shirts, no shoes, no service.' A shirtless customer tries to enter the store. Because the customer is not wearing a shirt, the store clerk explains the store policy and denies the customer entry. The customer happens to have a shirt in his bag, however, so he puts on his shirt and then tries to enter the store again. This time, the clerk sees the customer's shirt and permits the customer to enter. Now consider whether the customer is criminally liable for committing a trespass when he entered the store after putting on his shirt. The answer is obviously no. It is true that the clerk initially blocked the customer's entrance, and the customer then devised a way to circumvent the block. But no trespass occurred because no one would understand the store's policy as an effort to keep that specific customer out. The store's policy would be understood as allowing everyone to enter on the simple condition that they wear a shirt and shoes. No trespass occurred because wearing a shirt is not access restriction." End quote. These were strong arguments against Weave's conviction, which made it all the more surprising when, on the first day of the appeal, as Kerr was just beginning to present his case, one of the justices cut him off, wanting instead to focus on what many initially considered to be the least significant defense argument, the matter of venue. Back before the trial began, Thor had already questioned the prosecution's choice of venue. Trials are usually held in the state or even district where the crime took place. Weave was in Arkansas and Spittler in San Francisco. So why New Jersey?
I was like, okay, well, were there servers in New Jersey? Eventually I found out that the servers were in Atlanta, Georgia and Texas. Okay. Well, AT&T's in New Jersey, right? That's why we're in the District of New Jersey in Newark Federal Court, because that's where AT&T is, right? Okay, I look up that entity, and it's not based in New Jersey. I think it was based in Texas, right? So I'm like, okay. All right, well, what happened in New Jersey, right?
The government argued that New Jersey was a valid venue because out of the 114,000 email addresses Spittler and Weave had obtained from AT&T, about 4,500 belonged to New Jersey residents. But to Thor, this reasoning didn't add up. That was just 4% of the total emails, meaning the venue could just as easily have been almost any other state. So, again, why New Jersey? Thor thought he knew the answer. The prosecutors had chosen New Jersey because of a quirk in the state's laws. By simply accessing AT&T's servers, Spittler and Weave were potentially committing a misdemeanor. But by sharing the email addresses with the journalists, they were in violation of New Jersey's privacy statute, and this additional step turned the misdemeanor into a felony. In other words, the prosecution was forum shopping for a court most likely to support their cause and deal Weave a harsh sentence. On the surface, it might seem that the matter of venue is a mere technicality. But for Thor, it was anything but. His constitutional law lessons in law school had taught him that the founding fathers saw the choice of venue as a substantial constitutional right.
Well, it starts when they write the Constitution in 1787 in Article 3, which is about the judiciary. They put in that all trials must occur in the state where the crime occurred, because one of the things that was happening was the crown, the British crown, was arresting radicals in, say, Philadelphia, and then taking them to London for trial. Now, that's a very different jury in London if you're an American radical at that time than you would get in Philadelphia. And there's also other background principles to it, like originally it was sort of the jury theory. The jury is that the members of your own community who knew you would be judging you. It goes to the social and political background of the prosecution that you want sort of the veneer to the jurors to be from the same, you know, background network, sort of socially and politically or whatever. You know, it's the community deciding the law is what a jury is to me. So that's why it's in there. And it was so important that when they added the Bill of Rights in, was that 1790, in the Sixth Amendment, they reiterated the venue clause. And they said, not only does it have to be in the state where the crime was committed, but the district, which is, you know, states get divided up into districts for courts, that it occurred in.
But I want to push back on the venue issue, because I can see how back in the old days, being prosecuted in a venue near your peers is important. But in our modern day with digital crimes, why not have any venue you want? Because you could choose New Jersey, you could choose San Francisco, you could choose almost anywhere in the United States. Why not New Jersey?
Because it allows for prosecutorial abuse. It's hugely important, not only for the juror, but for the defendant's access to resources to put on a complete defense. And they know this. And the other issue here is, do you want any prosecutor anywhere in the United States to be able to sit down at a computer, interact with the website anywhere in the world and claim criminal jurisdiction? That just, to me, erases the venue clause, and it moves the scale of justice in favor of the prosecutors even further.
The justices of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with Thor. As the proceedings unfolded, they pressed the prosecution on the issue, with one justice pointingly reminding the government lawyer that venue is mentioned in two separate places in the United States Constitution. The appeal concluded more than a year after it began. It is now April 11th, 2014.
The story of that day is kind of fun, like, because I'm standing, it's, I don't know, like 10:30 in the morning, I'm standing getting my morning coffee at Brooklyn Roasting Company in Dumbo, and my partner, Mark Jaffe, like, calls me. I'm like, hey, Mark, what's up? He's like, did you hear? I was like, what are you talking about, man? Because, like, you know, this has been now, or like, it's like a year and a half after the trial, 2 years, something like that. And I'm like, no, what are you talking about? He's like, okay, we won. They vacated Weave's conviction. I'm like, holy fuck. Run to the office, right? My phone explodes. Press is calling. People are calling. Everybody's texting me. So I'm like, the first thing I thought was, how the fuck do I get him out of jail? It's a Friday, right? If I don't figure this out by 5 o'clock, you know, whatever, I get in front of the judge, it gets kind of rolled by 5 o'clock. He's going to be in jail over the weekend. No, you got to get him out. So I, like, the first thing I do is I reach out to my colleagues in the defense bar, and I'm like, hey, how do you get a guy out of jail after you've gotten his conviction vacated on appeal? And they all respond to me, don't know, never happened to me, right?
Ultimately, Thor got into his car and drove 2.5 hours to the prison in Pennsylvania where Weave was being held.
Pick him up, we got him out, and yeah, of course he was happy. We had him back at a party in New York City at 10:30.
Not surprisingly, after his release, Weave returned straight to his usual behavior.
He's like right back to his trolling, man. He gets, there's a show on CNBC, I think it's still out, called Power Lunch. And it's done from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And, you know, if you're pitching investors or stuff like that, it's prime real estate. You really want to be on it, right? Because you get all this, you know, everyone's eating lunch and watching the show from the, you know, stock exchange. He gets on it. And he gets on it. As you know, someone who just got out of jail, who's now going to start a fund that will short the stock of companies with bad information security, which isn't a bad idea at all. We started getting calls from investors and stuff like that, but it's like fucking hilarious. I was just like, this guy's like, you know, whatever you want to say about him, genius troll, right? And then he leaves the country because he's like, Tor, they're never going to stop.
According to rumors, Weave fled the U.S. for Lebanon, a country without an extradition treaty with the United States. Since then, he has reportedly lived in various countries across Eastern Europe and the Middle East, all the while continuing his trolling activities. In 2016, he sent thousands of neo-Nazi white supremacist flyers to unsecured web-connected printers at universities and other locations across the U.S. In 2020, he disrupted several webinars, a practice known as Zoom bombing, hosted by Jewish groups, launching into profanity-laced anti-Semitic tirades, and even removing his shirt to reveal the swastika tattoo on his chest. The fact that Weave won his appeal on the grounds of venue meant the court never addressed the defense's other key arguments, specifically those challenging the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act's broad and vague definition of what constitutes exceeds authorized access. In the wake of Aaron Schwartz's death, efforts were made in Congress to reform the CFAA. A proposed bill, dubbed Aaron's Law, sought to clarify and narrow the scope of the statute. However, those efforts stalled, leaving the law's critics disappointed. Change came instead through the courts. In 2021, the Supreme Court issued a ruling that narrowed the definition of exceeds authorized access. The court determined that employees who access information for work purposes but use it for non-approved activities cannot be prosecuted under the CFAA. A year later, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal further limited the law's reach, ruling that scraping data from a public website does not exceed authorized access, even if it was done against the explicit wishes of the website owner. In response to these rulings, the Department of Justice announced a new policy in 2022. The DOJ stated it would no longer bring CFAA prosecutions against individuals engaged solely in good faith security research. The Electronic Frontier Foundation welcomed the change as a step in the right direction, but argued it fell far short of the protections needed to shield security researchers from overzealous prosecutions. The EFF wrote on its website that, quote, "The policy is a good start, but it is no substitute for comprehensive CFAA reform. The CFAA remains a vague law that gives prosecutors and private parties significant discretion to attack security researchers, journalists, and follow-on innovators." End quote. The fight to reform the CFAA, it seems, is far from over. For Tor Eklund, Weave's case was life-changing. He divorced, quit drinking, and thanks to the publicity, began attracting more hackers seeking his legal expertise.
A lot of my clients choose to remain anonymous, and I just get a lot of calls when the DOJ prosecutes computer crime in the United States. And I also just consult with businesses around the world about complying with United States computer laws, which are very Byzantine and ever-changing.
Tor says that working as a criminal defense lawyer has profoundly changed his perspective on the U.S. legal system.
This law enforcement machine that I grew up thinking was honest, rational, and fair, even through law school, and now that I have seen it from the inside, I think it needs to be radically changed. I'm not anti-law enforcement, but I'm anti the law enforcement the way we have it now, which is way too big. There's way more law enforcement agents than there are actual crimes. So they invent the crimes to justify their careers. You have these elastic criminal statutes that can be made to criminalize just everyday normal behavior.
That's it for this episode. Thank you for listening. A big thank you to Tor Eklund. And Weave, if you're listening to this, I'd very much like to hear your thoughts. Write to me, ran@ranlevy.com. That's ranlevi.com. Malicious Life is produced by PI Media. The Weave mini-series was written by me, edited by Nate Nilsson, with sound design by Shelly Guetta. Our website is malicious.life. You can follow us on Twitter at @maliciouslife or follow me at @ranlevy. Thanks to CyberReason for underwriting the podcast. Learn more at cyberreason.com. Bye-bye. CK Music.